Track 16. We're getting to the end of the magazine, which leaves the past lives section about the people who made our county great. This month starts with brewer and bon vivere John Patson. Chris Armstrong looks at the riches to rags story of a remarkable and hospitable man.
Alderman Paterson gave an elegant entertainment at his house in Surrey Street. So read the Bury and Norwich Post of the 13th of January, 1802. John Paterson gave many such entertainments, but despite periods of great wealth and business success, he died an impoverished man, existing on a grant of £50 per annum paid to him as a decayed alderman. He must have been the despair of his eldest son, who spent much of his life trying to pay off his father's debts. But Paterson Senior was not just a spendthrift playboy from a rich family. He was a travelled man, a dedicated amateur soldier, an MP at times, an exceptionally shrewd businessman. He was born into a comfortably off family, primarily in ironmongering, but when John was nine, his father died. His mother, Martha, a formidable lady, moved with John and his younger brother to live with his uncle John in the fine house he had built in Surrey Street, Norwich. Uncle John was an extremely wealthy wool stapler and weaver whose free-spending habits became the pattern for John's own adult life. It was said of Uncle John that he burned all the bills for the Surrey Street mansion so nobody could see how much he'd paid. Unlike his younger brother, who went to Eton, John was educated either at Norwich Grammar School or at a school in Greenwich. The records are unclear. However, since by the time he was 12, he'd been dispatched in the charge of a family servant to complete his education in Leipzig, and neither can claim him as their own. Sending him to be educated in Germany was the choice of Uncle John, no doubt in cahoots with the determined and ambitious Martha. The company traded extensively in Germany, and John was expected to become fluent in German and to embed himself with the local business community, reinforcing already strong trading relationships. His uncle, a widower and heirless, intended to make John a partner in the business. John completed his education and returned to Norwich as an apprentice weaver, but when John was just 19, his uncle died. His will, of which John was the primary beneficiary, along with another protege, stipulated that for the next 3 years control of the company should devolve primarily on Martha, who kept a close and probably beady eye on John. While engaging in the business, he also found time to enjoy himself. Bath was much to his taste, as was the social life of London. Young, single, and rich, he made the most of them both. When the 3 years were up, John and the other main beneficiary of his uncle's will, Luke Iselin, were admitted to partnerships, but Martha continued to exercise a high level of authority. And in 1778, John left to spend time on the continent with a view both to strengthening business connections and to completing a mini grand tour. Fortunately, the email age was still 200 years away, so we can still enjoy the very engaging correspondence between mother and son. Within a month, Martha was complaining at the bills that John was running up. Norwich's worsted industry was entering its long decline, and business was not good. She was full of advice, too, on everything from his health to his choice of companions, and was particularly anxious about one nicknamed Richard the Rake. She was also keen that he should make an appropriate marriage. She favoured Bet Ives, the daughter of a prominent and wealthy Norwich merchant. John did his best to promote the company's business. From Lübeck, he reported that trade was slow as the merchants felt changing fashions were limiting demand. Martha sent him to give one particular customer, called Otto, a flea in his ear. He'd not made any orders recently because he found the prices too high. Martha expressed an anti-Semitic opinion of him and said that she wouldn't give a f*** for his friendship. But as the business continued to struggle, she changed her tune and instructed John to accept orders from Otto, regardless of profitability. In pursuit of his grand tour, John moved on to Italy, starting in Turin, where he said that he worked all morning and spent each evening at the opera, before travelling to Naples, Rome, and Sicily. He was treated with scant regard by Italian society because he was in trade and felt the business people he met were not of the calibre he had hoped. In Naples, he met the young John Soane, studying classical architecture on a Royal Academy scholarship. Soane's scholarship gave him just £60 per annum, while Patterson was struggling by on £500 per annum. Soane was glad enough to fall in with Patterson and fellow travellers who paid him to produce illustrations of the sites that they had visited. And later, when Soane was at the height of his fame, Patterson employed him to make alterations to the Surrey Street mansion, which he had inherited. Back in Norwich, and with Martha still on hand, he ran the business with Iselin and became heavily involved with civic affairs. He became sheriff at the age of 30 and mayor just 3 years later. He was a member of the corporation for half a century. On one occasion, attending an election, he was knocked down in a scuffle. The man concerned was arrested, but discharged on the bizarre grounds that he was drunk but respectable. John was also a director of Norwich Union and played a part in the eventual removal of its eccentric founder, Thomas Bignold. He married, not Bet Ives, as his mother had suggested, but another heiress, Elizabeth Staniforth of Manchester, and they had seven children, but sadly all seven predeceased him. Patterson also involved himself very effectively in the local militia. The history of this force was not entirely without blemish, but he was an effective commander, rapidly promoted from captain to colonel, and his corps was one of the few locally to be recognised as fit for service. He tried his hand at politics, too. Initially, he bought one of the rotten boroughs, later abolished by the 1832 Reform Act, at Minehead for 4,000 guineas. He was a bit ambivalent about financing his political career, subsequently hesitating before agreeing to stand in Norwich until a subscription was raised to meet his costs. Even when representing Minehead, he'd done his best for Norfolk, introducing to Parliament a petition on behalf of the distressed Norwich weavers and involving himself with a fight to reduce the tax on malt, a little self-interest here perhaps because he had started a brewing business. He'd started to take an interest in brewing in his mid-30s, claiming his intention was to find a business for his eldest son. At the time, his son was only 10 years old, and it seems probable that both for his son and for himself, he was looking to diversify the family's interests as the weaving industry in Norwich contracted. Whatever his reasons, he made a great success initially, and it's for his time as a brewer that he is primarily remembered today. He started in quite a small way originally in partnership with Charles Greaves, and then buying him out. His was the smallest of the 8 breweries in Norwich, producing just 3% of the total amount brewed in the city. Just a year later, he bought another brewery, that of James Beevor. John already owned 2 inns, one inherited from his father, the other bought as an investment. The acquisition of Beevor's brewery brought with it a number of other inns. And just 1 year later, he made his most significant purchase yet of Fisher's Brewery in Great Yarmouth. This was a much more substantial business, comprising not just the brewery, but also malt houses and inns. By 1800, he was the largest brewer in Norwich, supplying over 150 inns. The business had its principal premises in Pockthorpe, then not the most salubrious quarter of Norwich, but this didn't stop John from entertaining there, once giving a dinner for the visiting Prince William, nephew of George III, inside an empty vat, which was then named after the prince, who agreed to become godfather to one of John's sons. By then, the value of his brewing interests was computed as about £12 million by today's values. John had never been shy about spending money, having already bought 2 estates, and all seemed set fair. The mansion in Surrey Street had been extended under the auspices of John Soane, and had, according to one visitor, a style seldom seen but in the houses of our first nobility. His luxurious apartments accommodated visiting dignitaries and hosted lots of elegant entertainments. John had achieved everything that Martha had hoped for him, commercial success and social acceptance within the best society. But it was not to last. The evidence of what broke him financially is not wholly clear. Obviously, his huge social expenditure didn't help. Something like 200 paintings and all 3 estates, one inherited by his wife, 2 more purchased by him in his pomp, were sold off, and his wife agreed to forego the arrangements made for her potential widowhood, although he had in fact been selling off assets which were in trust for her without her knowledge. Economically, it was not a good time for extravagant spenders. In the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars, there was a huge slump, and there's some evidence to suggest that he had invested in a bank which failed, and that some of his continental interests lost money too. Whatever the reasons, one of John's worst moments came when he had to sell the Surrey Street mansion in which he and his uncle had invested so much capital, both financial and social. The purchaser was Samuel Bignold of Norwich Union. One rather touching aspect of the whole affair is even when the cracks appeared, he seemed to have retained a popular and respected local figure. It's inconceivable that his difficulties were not known to the business community, yet Norwich Union made him a huge loan. The equivalent of £2 million today was still outstanding at his death. His eldest son worked hard to pay off his debts, primarily by diluting the ownership of the brewing business by selling shares in the company, mainly to the Steward family. It would be nice to think that the generosity and consideration shown to John in later years was a reflection of what he had given earlier, both by his hospitality and his civic service. He was clearly a man of great character and charm, and an extremely generous host. It would have been a pleasure, one feels, to have known him. A fuller version of the life and career of John Paterson can be found in Chris Armstrong's book, Mustard, Boots and Beer, published by Lark's Press in 2014.